Hello, rap fans. It's Richard Herring here. Thank you for listening to my podcasts, powered by Acast Plus. Do tell your friends if you think they might enjoy them too. And do come and see me on tour in my show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all tour dates, going to lots of places in the UK. Some extra gigs added in London at the Leicester Square Theatre and the Bloomsbury Theatre. The Leicester Square Theatre first gig is very nearly sold out, so do rush along to those shows, London, if you want to come along. Some of the shows selling fantastically well, some of them selling pretty badly. Hello, Swindon. Do you know I'm coming to your town? Please buy some tickets. And I do have to give a trigger warning. I've done the show only a few times and 6 men have passed out. After the bit where I explain what happens to you during an operation for testicular cancer. So, are you man enough to handle my balls? Only come if you are, have lots of balls and are not scared of balls. There is some mild testicle trauma involved in this story of testicular cancer. It's mainly funny, though, and if you don't come, that means you're scared to come, and I'm going to judge you, so... It's like going on a fairground ride, so do come along. It's going to be very exciting to see if you make it through. I'll give you a badge if you make it through unscathed. Anyway, come and see the tour, richardherring.com for all that news. Some great Rahalastapas coming up, I have to tell you, in the next few weeks. The tour was a lot of fun. Thanks very much to everyone who came. Sit back, relax, and enjoy my stupid fucking podcast.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello, welcome to Rich Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast with me, Rich Herring, and my guest this week is Louis Theroux. It's very exciting. It's a very good one. I've seen it already, and it's excellent. This show is sponsored by Fallen London. It's an award-winning story-based text adventure game. You can play it for free in your browser. It's set in the reign of Queen Victoria. Sounds brilliant. Your time-travelling finger could go back there. London's been stolen and dragged below ground to a vast cavern where hell is close, immortality is cheap, and the wine is made of mushrooms. It sounds like Shepherd's Bush Post Office. Fallen London offers you different stories depending on your character's choices, who you piss off, who you seduce, who you beat up, and hundreds more. It's free to play and has been going for 6 years. There are 1.2 million words of darkly funny stories to enjoy, and you can sign up at failbettergames.com /RHLSTP. That will come up on the screen, won't it, Chris? To get a treat just for Rahalastapas listeners/viewers. Do support our sponsors. They've put some money into making these shows viable, and you get them for free as a result. So go to failbettergames.com/RHLSTP. Now let's enjoy Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast with Louis Theroux. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome a man who loves the movie Mistake Robert Webb show. That is his favourite show. It's Richard Herring. Wow. Gosh. You're so much better than those pricks we had in last week. They were idiots. I was going to give one of them this T-shirt last week, but I thought, no, they're such dicks. I'm not going to do that. So I was going to give this to someone who, the first person I could see wearing an I paid a pound badge, but I can't see anyone wearing one. And it's like people are looking away. They're saying, please don't let me have the... Please don't give it to me, Richard. Who's got one? There you go. That lady, that's nice there. That's... You've got one. It's not here. I just got one. You could be lying, but that's the allure of the feminine form to Richard Herring. Is if a woman says, "Please give me your T-shirt. Do you want my shirt as well?" You've already seen my nipple. There it is again. I only show this one because the other one's really weird. Boop.
That's the one without talcum powder. What's happening to me? What have I become? I used to be on the proper telly. What's happening to me? So we're going to... This guy wants to have a chat, so let's talk to you before we can. What's your name, sir? Steve, have you been to the show before?
I haven't.
You what? You've listened to them all, never been. It's very exciting being here in person, isn't it? I can actually spit on you from here. And what's been your favourite Rich Chang's Leicester Square Theatre podcast in the past so far? That was a good choice. That is one of the correct choices. What do you do for a living? You're a project manager. Yeah, that's what like kids do at school, right? There. So that the kids at school. I did one about the Peelers, Robert Peel. Would you come in and go, yeah, Richard, that's well done. You manage. Is that the kind of thing you do?
Yeah.
What was the last project you managed?
Something to do with credit cards.
Credit cards. God. Your life is much more boring than mine. Thanks for coming to the show. And there's a lovely young lady here. What's your name? Meredith, that's a nice name. And what do you do for a living? You're a student. What are you studying? Maths. What is the differential? What's the differential of 2x? 2, is that right?
Yeah.
All right, well done. Well, are you studying at university? Yeah, you should have got that a bit quicker. What is 7 times 8? Oh, for fuck's sake. The students today, as much, I've got 2 A-level maths, proper hard A-levels from when it was hard. I could tell you 7 times 8 like that. 56. So, I know 12 times 12 is 144. But look at that, bang. Just know that. I know that just off the top of my head. We used to have to learn times tables. Have you ever learned a times table in your life? Yeah, you have done. What's 7 times 8? 56. That's good. You can remember. That is the important thing. Right, so we're going to crack on. Oh, before we crack on with the show, I have to do one thing from this. I nearly forgot. It's from Francisco J. Banos. I mean, really? Seriously? We got a lot of foreign listeners to this podcast. Paco, that's my name, short for Francisco. What? I was born in and live in Spain, so I am right. There's a lot of Spanish fans. This is how a lot of Spanish people learn English. There's a lot of Spanish people going around calling people cunts. I love British comedy, so he backed the Kickstarter campaign for Rehelastapa. I think I forgot to do that, didn't I, at the top of the show? That's unusual. And Spanish people only know the Monty Python films and Mr. Bean, and a few of them remember Benny Hill. As you can imagine, Paco feels very lonely. He'd be willing to be adopted or to marry into a nice British family. Please. Just turned weird, hasn't it? I mean, if anyone wants to marry, become Mrs. or Mr. J. Banos, do get in touch with the podcast and we'll let you know. It's Richard Chang's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. I don't think I said that. And will you please welcome my guest today? Very excited to have him on. He is probably best known as the park ranger in the film Take a Peek. It's Louis Theroux, ladies and gentlemen, Louis Theroux. Come in. Thank you for coming in. Sit down here, pick up that microphone, then you talk into the microphone in a traditional manner. Surprisingly popular, Louis. Surprisingly popular.
I didn't know that many people had seen Take a Peek.
It's a very popular film.
It is a good film, but I thought it was underappreciated. It turns out it found its audience.
It did. They're all here. They're hoping for the number 2 where you'll take your trousers off. Because you were involved. This is a porn film you were in.
Yeah.
And a proper porn film.
It was released. I was living... it was in New York around the time I made... Take a Peek. The backstory is I was making a documentary about the porn industry.
Yeah.
And it was part of a series called Weird Weekends, and the concept of the series was that I would get involved in outre lifestyles. And so the porn one, I thought, well, what should I do to get involved? And naturally, it seemed like I should be in a porn film. And that it felt safer in some way to be in a gay porn film. So I got cast as in a non-sex role as a park ranger, and It was called Snowbound while we were shooting it. The concept was that it was a skiing party, and these guys had gone to the mountains outside Los Angeles, and then a convict had escaped from the local prison. And quite a sexy, young, buff, muscly convict. And I played the park ranger, and I arrive at their house, and I say, good evening, gentlemen. I'm just out here. I can remember the lines. It's so cool. I'm just out here telling everybody about an escape from a local prison. Take a look at this composite. I kept saying composite. I couldn't remember, like, what was the English way of saying it? What was the American way? And if you see anyone, just give me a call. And they have a look at it, and one goes, oh, he's kind of cute. And then I think subsequently, like, the convict arrives, and they get to know each other, and I don't want to spoil the ending. But the funny thing was, I was living in New York, and I went to my local video store. We still rented videos in those days. That's really dating me, isn't it? Went to the video store to get a movie out, and it was on, and Take a Peek was there on the shelf. And I thought, wow, that thing that I made is actually there. It's a real film, and I didn't rent it, but I do have a copy of it.
Yeah,
we should do another of these. I'll bring it along, and we'll kind of do like you know, one of those like a director's evening where they just talk scene by scene. What I was thinking when we made Take a Peek.
As the park ranger, though, weren't you in character a little insulted that the men didn't want to have sex with you? It wouldn't be quite nice to go, do you want to have sex with me? No.
Well, one of the weird things was they'd asked for my measurements for the uniform, right?
Yeah.
And then when I arrived, I put the uniform on, it was three sizes too small. And so the only conclusion was that they'd asked for my measurements so they could make sure they got me the wrong size. and then whether or not I had a sort of sexual dimension, I'd like to think that, like, I was the sort of the unattainable, tantalizing
for a lot of
authority figure.
Yeah, well, a lot of viewers will be really getting off on that. It's like presented with this man that you don't get to see.
It's like
naked.
Buñuel, that obscure object of desire. That the I think that's what they were thinking of, probably. You know, the unattainable icon of sexuality that's never quite reached.
I think they were. It was one of my favourite episodes. I guess this was like early 90s, was it late 90s?
We shot that in 97, I
right,
think.
Right, 97. Yeah. So I remember seeing this The Weird Weekend about the... I mean, I really loved the series straight away, but the porn one really made me... Because it struck home with me, and, you know, I occasionally watched pornography, and then I watched your programme, and then all the people, and it was so damaged, and...
Yeah.
There was the guy called JJ who was very memorable, who you said, aren't you worried about AIDS? And he goes, well, I don't think about it, so I'm all right. And you kind of go, that's not how the AIDS virus works. The AIDS virus isn't going, damn, it's not like a Doctor Who villain. If you think about it, it gets you.
Yeah.
It's like, as long as you're not thinking about me, it's, damn, I can't get to JJ. And everyone was so vulnerable and broken, it actually made me stop watching pornography for a while. And I remember talking about Stuart Lee. I talked to Stuart Lee about it, and I said, you know, this is, you watch this program, it's terrible, it'll make you stop watching porn. And Stu went, no. I'm not going to get on board with that one. But it was, I think it was sort of archetypal of that early work you did, those early, it's kind of interesting because it's much more skittish and it's quite childish in a lot of ways, I think, than certainly compared to your more recent stuff, but you still kind of worked it hit home. I think the memorable bit in it is where you're talking to the guy who's straight, but he works in gay porn films.
Yeah,
and you're going
Take a Peek, and I say, go on.
Well, you can tell.
What do I say? Go on.
You say. You tell me what you say because I'll get it wrong.
Well, is it the bit? There's a bit that makes me cringe. You know, there's some stuff that I did in the early days, and when you're sort of straining to make a scene interesting or funny, and you say stuff, and I look back and I think, oh, that was maybe a little bit too far with that one. And there's a bit after he's what's called gay for pay, and so he says he's straight, but will work in gay films, and then he goes and does his scene, and he comes out afterwards, you know, a gay sex scene. with the convict, I think. And he comes out afterwards and he goes, I go ski. And he sort of made this face of like, he said, well, I just, oh no, that's right. He said, I just made $300. Right. And like, kind of like boasting. And I sort of took, I kind of rankled, you know, like, yeah. Oh, well, bully for you. And like, so I go, yeah, but you were going down on a man. I know, this is terrible, isn't it? And then he said, yeah, unfortunately. And then that rankled even more, right? Because then I'm thinking, well, what I said, which was, oh, come on, you enjoyed it. I know, that one, that's the bit where I look at it now and I think, because he looked pained at that point. Well, and we had a little rapport going. And I sort of slapped him in the face.
Well, it was. It's a very bold thing. I mean, you're sort of going, you must have enjoyed it a bit. You know, you were yeah. like, you're enjoying it. You must have been enjoying yeah. it. You must enjoy it, you know. And he's really uncomfortable. But I think somehow that it does, you know, weirdly enough, watching them again, because they're on Netflix, so I've kind of watched, I've gone back and watched a lot of them. And those early ones, there are moments you think, oh, that is a bit pathetic.
Right.
But
things that I do that
yeah,
pathetic.
Yeah, yeah. Compare, they're just childish. They're just because yeah. you're a young yeah. guy. I mean, but at the time, I watched them and enjoyed yeah. them because I was a young guy as well. Yeah.
But pathetic, that's quite strong. Right? You're processing.
It was a badly chosen.
I said, like, some bits make me cringe. I don't think I said any of it was pathetic.
I was just giving you a bit of a...
Is that what this show's like? You bring people out and you insult them.
I was giving you a bit of the Louis Theroux treatment back, my friend. Then you know how it feels.
Now I know how Troy yeah. felt when I said that. Go on. What's so pathetic about these shows that I made?
They're puerile is possibly a more...
That's all right, yeah. yeah. Puerile I can live with.
But then you've
pathos,
got...
actually, I always used to say, where is the pathos?
Yeah.
You know, even in the Weird Weekends days, I, two-thirds of the way through, in a sort of third act, I'd say, like, we need a moment of pathos where our sort of designated person who's involved in the weird lifestyle, be it JJ or whoever... where they're shown, after having sort of been treated as somewhat silly, they're shown in a position of vulnerability.
Yeah, yeah, definitely, yeah.
So is that what you meant when you said pathetic? pathos.
Yeah,
yes.
I guess that was. Yeah. They're very despite their basic patheticness, they are very... No, they're very moving, and you do get into being with the people. There's a weird voyeurism in them, I suppose, as well. You're picking on people who are... You're choosing people who are...
So they're voyeuristic.
Well, you're choosing
pathetic.
People who are... A lot of the shows are people who are broken in some way.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, is interesting to see, because, as I say, I think that poor mom really did affect the way I looked at my life and other people's life and your own culpability and responsibility in that. So it was a very powerful episode as well. And the follow-up that I watched today, which I don't think I'd seen before, where you go back in yeah. 12 years' time, and again, you're a bit more mature. And you see JJ again, and he then reveals that his baby had just died when he was doing it. So yeah. It gives this amazing context to it, that to go back, and one of the actors has killed themselves.
Yes.
And
it was... I try not to go back and revisit stories, but it's sort of a rule I have that you know, I don't know. Some people get over-interested in their own oeuvre, you know, and it's a bit tedious. Do you know what I mean?
I do know. Like I'm very much like that.
George Lucas going back and saying, like, I'm going to completely redo, which was the one, and he just sort of added some CG,
yeah.
like Jabba the Hutt is going to be completely different in this version. And you went and you sat and paid money to go and see Star Wars or anything like that. This is exactly the same. But he obviously was obsessed with improving the special effects, and I have a similar impulse that I strenuously try to resist. But I gave in on that one, mainly because... I'd heard that one of the main characters in the first Bourne doc that I'd done had killed himself, and I thought, well, that's interesting. Oh, and the other thing was that I'd heard that the porn industry had died, and that as a result of online piracy, basically the job of the male performer, which is what the first one had been about more than the female performer, the male performer no longer existed. You know, that there was no longer enough work for porn performers to get jobs.
Yeah.
And I thought, that's interesting, the death of the industry and the fact that there's all these guys, 45-year-old guys, who for 20 years have worked as woodsmen, using it as a technical term there for you, and now they can't get any work. You know, you go out to the job centre and they say, what have you been doing for 20 years? Like, what are you skilled in? You say, well, I can get an erection and I can keep it under hot lights for you know, a couple of hours at a time. And they say, okay, well, we'll let you know if anything comes in. So that was the premise. That was for the premise of the show. And as you rightly say, I went back, and partly it was also seeing what had happened to JJ, who, when I first interviewed him, had only been in a couple of weeks, and when I went back, he'd actually got out. Having done it for sort of 5 or 6 years, he was now out and leading a normal life. But he revealed that he had this very sad thing that had happened to him that had got him in for the first time.
Well, but all of those people did within it. The guy talked to in the second one, who's 40-odd and sort of going, oh, I'm not sure I'm going to meet a nice woman. And, you know, he's in the business, but he's kind of starting to have thoughts about whether it's the right thing to be doing for his life. But he really reminded me of lots of comedians who do the same. Basically go, oh, I'm 40 years old, and maybe myself included. Oh, I really wish I could settle down and be happy, but they still carry on with their, you know, essentially porno lifestyles.
No, because actually, I've done a number of shows that are about versions of kind of self-impersonation, or where you are a version of yourself, but you sort of prostitute yourself in some sense,
yeah,
by taking real things about yourself, whether it's your sex life, you know, or in wrestling is a bit like that as well. You know, your athleticism, and then you bastardize it and you put it on stage and you mix real things with fake things, and to the point where your psyche becomes confused. I find that really interesting because it's both deeply sad and quite funny. And I've always felt like with no offense, you know, but the world of stand-up comedy is riddled with that as well.
No, definitely.
And I've always wanted to make a program about that, about stand-up comedy.
Are you doing that now? This would be a very clever way in.
This
I play myself
research.
A snooker in my basement and commentate on it. So there's an in for you.
Is that you saying you would be willing to be in the documentary if I made it?
I think there are more interesting comedians who are more screwed up than I am. I think if anything, it is similar because as a comedian, I play around with mental illness as a comedian and a perception of myself. And in different ways. But there is that danger that it'll be like the Cold Its episode where the guy pretends to be mad and then he can be let out to go, and then he just actually is mad and so they let him go.
I think
you worry as a comedian that if you're playing around with those things, and
no,
I think
exactly.
you're sort of skirting around with being, you're a crazy person or you're doing something. If, you know, playing myself at snooker in the basement, which I'd done 56 times as a podcast, 57 maybe, there are times when I'm doing that and go, this is genuine, my wife hates it, and I'm genuinely mad. And there are times that I think I'm in control of what I'm doing and I know why I'm doing it, which is probably more mad than the times I feel mad. So, you know, you are playing around with that, and I think sometimes you're revealing a lot of stuff about yourself in your act. And so, you know, you do sort of think, and that's why that guy reminded me of a comedian, because he's like, he's doing this act of going, yeah, I should, you know, I'm worried that I'm losing connection with my heart. And then you get all these comedians who do these shows, which are, finally, I'm going to find a wife and rather than sleep around, which I'm sure I've...
The guy you're talking about is Tommy Gunn.
Yeah, Tommy Gunn.
And he's an aging porn performer who's in the second one we did. And basically, what we'd wanted to do was find someone who was at that point where he thought, I've been doing this for 30 years. And he actually was still getting a bit of work, but he sort of felt in some way disconnected from himself. And he was... Paradoxically, you know, he was having sex, you know, 6 or 7 times a week with various beautiful women, but couldn't find love, and then was kind of in this self-exploratory way, saying, you know, I got my heart in a box, and I've thrown away the key, and I just got to find the key. And then you thought, like, is that real, or have you just done a lot of acting classes?
Yeah, that's what it looks like.
Yeah.
It looks like a part of the persona. You've lost lost connection, so you're trying to look more interesting or look like you're going to stop doing this thing. And actually, if you're going to stop doing it, you just stop doing it. You don't, and I've just, you know, I've seen that
through lots of comedians.
I have the sense, though, that you would be a good... and I don't want to put you in this sort of on the spot, Richard. But, you know, I have the sense that you would be a good contributor. It's what we call the people that I talk to in my programs. A good contributor in one of my documentaries.
Okay.
I actually think that, and I think, I you know, I'm embarrassed to say, and I mean that, actually, seriously, that I'm not as familiar with your stand-up as I would ideally like to be. I sort of gave up going to see stand-up a few years ago, but I feel as though if I knew your work better, there's a fragility in you that's very interesting, and I think it has a sexual... There's a sexual side of you that I'd like to explore.
Will you put on the Park Ranger outfit? Because then we've got to go.
Well, are you comfortable, you know, going with that, or is that weird?
Yeah.
You've probably talked about that in your stand-up, haven't you?
Well, I think, like, when I'm doing all 12 of my shows here at the Leicester Square Theatre in August and September, come and see them all. And then you can see the whole progression. And it's quite an interest. I think it's interesting to do that, to go back over 12. I've done 12 shows in 12 years. More or less, I think I had 1 year off, so it's like 12.
I could probably name the show. You do very good, like, you've always got a good title, good posters.
Yeah, but you never come and see them. but, you know, I think that goes on a journey from me, you know, the first one's about my relationship with Jesus, and then there's ones after that. Christ on a bike, yeah, and then Talking Cock, which wasn't really about me so much, except that I'm obsessed with... certainly was obsessed with sex. But then the ones after that, I think you go on this this ups and down curve of kind of loneliness and wanting to be in a relationship, but not finding a relationship.
Are you comfortable talking about this? I'm not trying to be weird. Were you a sex addict?
not in the... I mean, not compared to some of the people you've talked to.
Not diagnosed.
In your things. I think not by the standards of some, you know, the Russell Brand.
Do you know the definition?
just to be honest, I get to sex and then I'm so excited and I can't get beyond. I think, you know, I was definitely promiscuous and I definitely wasn't really interested in being in a relationship. So I think that's, you know, I'd have relationships for a bit and then I would have very itchy feet and want to get back to where I was before. So it was a thing that I had not a problem with because it was quite good. but on the whole, it was, you know, there was ups and downs with it. Hey. You know, I wouldn't say compared to certain, you know, there were a lot more voracious and out of control comedians than myself.
Because for it to be an addiction, and it is a contentious point because some people don't believe that, you know, sexual addiction exists, but clinically you should have, it should be interfering negatively. It should be sabotaging your life in some way, interfering with your work, and it doesn't sound like it was.
No. It was a help with my work, if only. Because then I could do jokes about it. I know, but I think there were...
You didn't leave... Because really, you know, Russell Brand, I've read his, you know, my book, you work in...
Yeah.
Do you remember there's a bit where he spits in a woman's face? That's in the book. I'm not giving you some inside gossip. So there's a darkness there that he's acknowledged.
No, I mean, I always liked women, and I hope that I was not unpleasant to anyone. So there wasn't a darkness in it. It was just I was a bit lonely, I suppose.
You would just get bored, like you would have sex with a woman, and you'd be like, I'm not interested in having sex with you. Wouldn't it be I would have thought if you were a sex addict, it'd be easier just to keep having sex with the same person. Rather than have to go and find a new people.
I believe that would be the challenge with someone
or sexually voracious, but you would get bored in you would just have a low boredom threshold in the relationship.
You know, it's become me, and I don't think this is me. I don't think it's me because I was too shy. People had to come and talk to me. I would never go and chat someone up. When Russell Brand was here doing this, I mean, he was sort of straight out into the audience to chat with people and ask them questions. And he was very full on, you know, and I found that sort of a bit embarrassing. That you would behave in that way. So I find a lot of... When I interviewed him after the show, he was sort of straight out to meet the audience.
Wow.
Now, he wouldn't have been that interested in you and you. And you. He chose the wrong show to come to, really. It's mainly men who work in IT here, so it's a chat. This is the one show where the gents' toilet queue is very long and the women can go in and go to the toilet. But there were, because he was on, there were some women in the audience. And maybe because of you. But no, I mean, I think it's very fascinating, all of that. But I think it's, I found it quite difficult to be on stage. I was able to be rude and be gregarious. But in real life, I always found that embarrassing. I find it embarrassing when comedians are just basically hanging by the bar. Hoping, you know, and chatting up every single woman that passes.
Well, but you said that you were sexually voracious, right?
Women were coming up and I was meeting women who would talk to me, but
they were coming up to you. I'm a man, and you don't just sit around. Women don't just come up to you.
Look at the moneymaker. After what I did.
I'm looking at the moneymaker.
In my 30s, I got a bit better at realising that you have to be proactive in terms of meeting people. If you want to meet a friend or have sex with someone, you've got to talk to people. I did a show called The 12 Tasks of Hercules Terrace, and one of the things I did in that was I dated 50 women in 50 consecutive days.
That's right.
That's
why I'm partly remembering this thing.
And that made me realise that it was actually quite easy to meet people and be polite and just be honest and chat to people. It was very easy to meet people. And I think before that, I was sitting at home a lot in my house and going, I don't know where, you know, how do I go out? How do I meet people? I think now it's so easy to meet people because you just, you know, you've got Tinder and you've got the internet, and it's insanely easy to meet people if you want to get into that. But I was always quite shy, so I don't put myself in the same bracket as some of those comedians. But, you know, I because I was single until I was 40, really, I had girlfriends, you know, I've slept with quite a lot of people, I suppose.
I always think that the difficult bit can't be... Was he boasting?
I'm going to
let that go. That's the
ashamed.
Other thing about sex addicts. They go, I've got a real problem. I just can't stop sleeping with beautiful women. You think you don't think that's a problem. That's just a pretext for you to boast about it, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I know you wouldn't do that. For me, the other thing is that it's not so much in theory. This is all theoretical, clearly. But it wouldn't be. It's not so much. It would be tricky necessarily to meet a beautiful woman and have a relationship. But then, how do you end it? Like, how are you moving on to the next woman in that scenario?
Well, I mean, a lot of them wouldn't be classified as relationships that you have to end, I think, in that situation. But I think I just realised being honest was the best way to... Even if you're a cynical person, being honest is the best. If you want to date people, just be honest about it. Because there's lots of people out there and lots of, you know... Lots of men have the idea that women, you know, don't want to have sex or don't want to be in relationships. But there's an equal amount of women who want to behave badly as there are men. That's how it works. There has to be for it to work in a consensual
fashion.
I'm not
sure if that's true.
Well, it is. So if you want, there's enough people that if you want that, go and find those people.
There are gay men that cottage right on Hampstead Heath.
Yeah,
and I'm fine with that. But there are no. there's, as far as I know, there aren't lesbian women cottaging on Hampstead Heath.
No, but I think it's more than, you know, it's very...
So doesn't that disprove...
I think it's still very easy. That's a certain type of someone who wants sex in that way. I don't think that's about...
So where are the women cottaging? Tell me that.
You have to go and, you know, talk to women and buy them a drink and then that sort, you know. What I realised from that doing that dating thing was that just if you behave like a reasonable human being and are polite and ask some questions and wash yourself, then you've got a pretty good chance of... And if you actually... The best thing about it was realising that... I'd literally just ask friends of friends, and so there was no let's put together two people who'd be good together. But a lot of people you'd meet someone and go, oh no, that's not my type of person. But if you had to spend an evening talking to them, you would often like them, you know, you'd like them in a way you weren't expecting at the beginning of the evening, so you'd make a prejudgment. So I think all this Tinder and stuff's all well and good, but actually It was sort of like a very slow speed date. Mm. And I, in that thing, I met about six women that I would really like to have had relationships with. It was very, very confusing for me. And I did end up going out with one of the women in the end for a year or so. But it was, you know, because I was going out with 50 women, it was kind of quite hard to forge a relationship. You know, do you want us to have a second date? I can't. I'm seeing 48 other women. So you got to the end and the ones you'd liked had met someone else or gone back to their old boyfriends or whatever. So it was, you know, it was confusing, but very interesting time. But, yeah, you need a different comedian than me. I'm fine. Talking of... I'm a nice guy. Talking of that, so what about Jimmy Savile then? So you did a series that was called, let me get this right, When Louis Met Loads of Sex Offenders. And some of them turned out to be innocent. You interviewed Jimmy Savile, Max Clifford. Do you think it was talking to you that turned them into sex offenders?
I wish I could say that talking to me would have cured them of being sex offenders, which it seems to have done in this case.
We've worked out a lot of things. I feel a lot better.
What can I say about that? It's a toxic area to talk about, but I'm happy to go there.
Well, it's sort of astonishing. I've just read the In Plain Sight book.
Yeah,
by Dan Davis.
Dan Davis' book about Jimmy Savile,
which is just utterly bewildering. I think there was rumours about him. As I was saying backstage to you, that me and Stuart Lee in This Morning Richard Not Judy did two jokes about Jimmy Savile, one of which was us dressed as Jimmy Savile at the beginning of a show. It was the day of the London Marathon, and we said, "All right, now then, it's the day of London Marathon. I hope nobody dies. If they do, Bagsy, I take them to the mortuary." And we did another joke, which was like the thing cutting out for a bit, and then it came back to us, and then me saying them. And apparently that's what Jimmy Savile and his brother get up to at the weekend. So we'd heard these rumours, but I'd kind of assumed that necrophile rumour was just an urban myth kind of thing. Because there's no way. How do you prove that someone's a necrophile?
I think necrophile is one of the few that is still unconfirmed.
Right.
I know that Paul Gambaccini has said that... he can't be claiming to have witnessed it, but
no.
I think he said that. I think what happened in that one was that he was a he volunteered a lot. Jimmy Savile volunteered a lot at Leeds General Infirmary, and in his book, which is called As It Happens, he talks about his fascination with death in general. He refers to the time that he spent with his departed mother, the Duchess, when they were Catholics, and according to tradition, she was laid out in a wake. And he said that the five days he spent next to her dead body were the happiest days of his life. And he would also he talks a lot about the great, wonderful, and beautiful privilege of being with someone as they die. And and some of the more sentimental passages in his book are about that. So he definitely had a fascination with death. There's also in one or two, I've read most of the inquiries into his offending. There's lots of them, and anywhere he ever did any voluntary work or any kind of work, BBC, all the police, relevant police authorities, West Yorkshire Police, Sussex Police, Leeds General Infirmary, Broadmoor, Stoke Mandeville, they've all published inquiries. And in one of them, and I can't remember which one, there's a reference to him having taken a glass eye from a dead body. Did you know this?
Yeah.
And so that's written up as the offence is interfering with a dead body.
Right.
So it's an easy to see how that could be construed as a sexual act.
Yeah, but people were talking about this. So we're talking about this. I mean, and it seems
I feel like it went into a lot of detail about... Yeah. Probably more than anyone was interested in. But I've grappled with, as someone who made a documentary about him and failed, I spent 10 days with him and failed to reveal the fact that he was, one of the most prolific sex offenders, of modern times, possibly. But I feel a sense of responsibility that I'm trying to go back and figure out how did I miss that. Although, interestingly, if you look at the... I'm just going to go on and on about this, aren't I? But one of the if there's a little bar chart where they've collated all the reported incidents of offences, and do you know that 2001, the year that I was with him for 10 days or so, there's no victims.
Right.
Did you dress up in your Park Ranger outfit and put him off? He was put off for a year. Well, I mean, but you know, everyone was letting this go. People were seeing this happening, and it was a. I can't understand it, because I remember growing up in the 70s and saying, don't get into people's cars. If people knew there were paedophiles, they knew there were people preying on. I suppose in the 70s, maybe they were dividing it between children and then sort of. You know, teenagers were, it was a different thing, or I don't know, it's just like...
I think there's an element of that, that he would maybe, yeah, maybe, I mean, as soon as you start to try and understand it, I think you're already on a slippery slope, because there was a part of it that was just people not wanting to believe the worst, you know,
yeah.
And I think... None of us wants to believe that someone we know is a sex offender. And in fact, life would become unlivable if you assumed the worst about people on a daily basis.
Yeah. I mean, I think the fact that nobody, you know, that it got to beyond his death before anyone was taking it seriously, it's not like you can say you're an idiot for not noticing at the time. And he obviously wasn't going to be giving that sort of stuff away to you within that interview, but it's...
No. And you know, I've watched the programme, you know, when Louis met Jimmy, you know, since the revelations came out, and I feel as though it still stands up as a show, you know, and actually a lot of the pieces are there. It's just the little keystone is not there. There's a scene in which I knew when I was making it that there was... That his sexual side I had not really fully understood, and I always feel, you know, as you may have noticed, you know, I feel like to get to know who someone is, you know, in their sexual dimension. You know, it sounds a little bit weird, but you know, I feel like that's it's such an important part of who someone is, and with Jimmy Savile, clearly. No one really knew. Like he'd never been married. He'd never been linked to any girlfriends. Some people thought he might be gay. There were rumours that he was a paedophile. That, as you say, had an unhealthy interest in corpses. There was a rumour that he was interested in disabled people. And I'd heard all these rumours, although, you know, not in a sort of, I work at the BBC and I. As you know, I'm in the corridors of power, so I hear these rumours. It was more just sort of playgrounds.
Yeah.
You know, people would say, or at school, or friends' mums, or, you know, you say, oh, my friend's mum said that he fiddled with, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's how you would hear about anything. Oh, right, friend of a friend. You know, like, and like a lot of rumours, you don't give them much credence. But I knew that there was a question that hadn't been answered to do with what his interests were. And there's a scene in the documentary where I'm in the room in Scarborough where he keeps his mother's clothes, and he dry cleans them once a year. And his relationship with his mother, it comes out how you know intense it was, you know, almost obsessional. And there's a weird photo that we look at where his mum, sort of like wrinkly old sort of lady, sitting, you know, with sort of granny glasses in a chair, and Jimmy's like sitting with his legs stretched out, kind of at her feet, wearing this sort of, I don't know if it's a smoking jacket or a really short dressing gown that just comes to the sort of the top of his thighs.
Yeah.
Reading a book or something with his sort of mid early 70s when he was at the height of his long platinum hair, and there's something really odd about the photo, and we have a conversation, and I sort of say, what, you know, what I'm saying is like, what are you, you know, what is your thing, you know? Yeah. But what I say is like, oh, you know, you've never been linked to anyone, you've never had any girlfriends, and I don't nail it, you know, I don't get to what it is. He just says, I've got lots of girlfriends that are girls, you know. You know, plenty, but girlfriends, never. You know, and we let it go. But when I look back, that's the moment where it's in my hands and it slips away.
I'm going to blame you. I've decided. I mean, it's utterly fascinating and horrible. It's horrific. I mean, that book's horrific. It's just such an horrific, unbelievable subject. But I don't, you know, but I think maybe, you know, in show business, people are so weird that, and he was very clever about it. I think all the dressing up in stupid clothes is a way of distracting, isn't it? You don't take him seriously as a
threatening... I think the most revealing possible... Well, one of the most revealing things in the show is the moment when... After I've gone to bed, the one bit I'm not involved in, my director stayed up and continued to film semi-secretly.
Yeah.
And Jimmy talked about how he would, when he ran nightclubs, he would type, if there were kids in there that he didn't like or giving him hassle or being leery, he would, he said, I never took them to the police. I would, or never chucked them out, never threw anybody out. I would take them down to the boiler room and tie them up. And leave them there to the end of the night to intimidate them. And he said, and the police came. You know, when I used to do this story, I'd do a Jimmy Savile, and I'd kind of touch a Jimmy, but it's almost like it's got to the point where just to do the voice feels a bit weird, doesn't it? But anyway, he would say to the police, they'd come around, and the police said, hey, Jim, you know, you were a bit heavy with that lad. And he'd say, you know, your daughter comes in here, tell me, and I'll let those filthy slags... have a go at her. And then, all right, Jim, you didn't give him half enough. And it's basically what it is that his ability to face police, to cultivate relationships with authority figures, including police, and his ability to in situations where he's faced with direct accusations of criminal behaviour, and he overawes the police, you know.
Yeah,
and again, since he died, it's come out that the police went to him with allegations of sexual abuse and sexual offending, and he sat down with him, and he just kind of bulldozed them, you know. I mean, I find that amazing because I'm a sort of I'm someone who sort of wants to confess to things that I haven't done. Do you know what I mean? Like I feel like I go around like if someone. Says something terrible's happened. I start feeling responsible, or if a policeman says something to you know. I don't know. I'm sort of drenched in a sort of weird anxiety, and so the idea that you've prolifically offended, and then the police come, and instead of getting the sweats, and you just kind of face them down. It's amazing to me. But that's what I think more than anything else. Whatever you call that, chutzpah. Gaul, he had that.
Yeah.
And I think that's how he got away with it.
And do you think it's a conspiracy that goes all the way to the top, that there were, you know, gangs of these people operating together and protecting each other, or do you think it's...
I would say I don't believe that. But then, you know, I didn't believe Jimmy Savile was a sex offender. No. So I sort of feel like my judgment is
it's terrible.
It's been called into...
Why am I asking you anything? I mean, some of the stories...
I didn't even think you were a sex addict.
When the stories came out, some of them sound like alien abductions. You know, they're so... When they say people saying, oh, we went into a dressing room in the BBC and 30 cameramen and, you know, all the audience were all fucking each other. There's those sort of stories that sound like alien abduction stories. So I think that's how you... You know, because obviously there are fantasists, but, you know, there might be fantasists within this many, many true stories. So it's very easy to go, oh, these are just crazy people saying this and this and this. So you can deflect it with one thing. But then I start thinking, well, maybe that story, maybe there was. Maybe where all the cameramen? I just can't believe it. I haven't
heard that exact story.
Well, there's a story about going in and lots of the crew being involved in.
I didn't know that. Which report
but
is that?
I don't know. I saw it somewhere, but you know, it just doesn't sound like it could be true. Knowing what you know about how the BBC works and how also the way that people would go, someone would go, oh, this is a bit weird. maybe I should mention that. But, you know, there's loads of things that people don't mention. People
I tend to think he would have been offending, you know, most of the time privately, you know, in his caravan, in his own dressing room. The idea of masses of cameramen being involved, I think that way, I think he would have got caught. And I don't tend to think, you know, I mean, I'm a skeptic about conspiracy theories, not absolutely, but I always think, you know, you've got to rule out stupidity first before you leap to a conspiracy theory, yeah. You know? And so, my knee jerk view is that, There isn't a sort of well-organized paedophile ring that's existed for years at the top echelons of power. But, if the evidence comes out that it's real, I'll believe it.
Yeah. I mean, what I found surprising is like a lot of the people who were interviewed about Jimmy Savile were immediately then arrested by people. You know, like Max Clifford was on, and Paul Gambaccini was interviewed.
Well, Max Clifford came out and said, I can't really do the voice, but he goes, celebrities are getting very, very nervous. And a lot of people think that, you know, it's going too far. And a lot of celebrities can't remember what happened 20, 30 years ago. And then it turned out like, no, well, Max Clifford was very nervous.
Yeah.
And then he was brought in and arrested. Yeah, he's doing porridge as well.
No, any clue when you saw him, when you spent lots of time
well,
with him?
Well, early on, you know, I remember, you know, I think I saw you quite soon after the first Exposure documentary.
Yeah.
And we were talking about this. And do you remember around that time, there were a lot of whispers about who's going to be next?
Yeah.
And I can't remember who, but someone said to me, Max Clifford's in the frame. And I remember thinking, I wasn't that surprised, mainly because I didn't have any inkling that he was a sex offender. I didn't have any privileged information, but I was aware that, you know, what his main, you know, he's a reputation management was what he did. He would either take you down or build you up. Stars, celebrities would pay him, and all he would do really. Would pay showgirls or women who are willing to be paid to be seen on the arm of his clients. When I was with him, it was Simon Cowell. So he got a stripper from Spearmint Rhino to take photos with Simon Cowell and say that she was Simon Cowell's girlfriend and sort of feed the tabloids stories, which would then prevent them from reporting real stories about whatever Simon Cowell was actually interested in.
Yeah.
And so I think, like, what, you know, about which one could speculate all night.
He likes putting on kind of contests between singers and stuff. He loves judging them.
Right.
That's what he's really interested in. That's what I've heard.
And it could be, it could actually be as awful as that. But that's a frightening thought.
Yeah, it is.
But I hadn't heard that rumor, to be honest with you. So the idea that, you know, once you see, I think, women as currency, that you pay, you know, go out with this bloke, okay. And then if he didn't like you, there would be, a woman would come and say, oh, I've slept with that person. So he'd either hurt you or help you.
Yeah.
By basically paying women. And I think once you see women as currency in that way, the idea that you're going to pay them to do this, or because what came out of the trial, I think, was that he would promise women stardom or success if they would give him sexual favors.
Yeah.
And you can see how there's a spectrum that he's going on, you know, more or less trafficking in women. So it all sort of, it sort of made sense.
Well, they're sort of similar in their, this veiled threat that they both, you know, they both clearly would you know, abuse people in whatever way to get where they wanted to go, even outside of the sexual arena. They were just both, it was the power, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But then a lot of, I mean, I suppose that's it. With great power comes great responsibility. Spider-Man was right.
He had a lot of power, but he also, and the other thing that he would lie a lot. Like when I was with him, I was always aware. He was a really tricky character. You know, one of the things he would do, the first time I met him, and he would do this to all journalists. He's one of the few people who, before I actually made the documentary, he insisted on a meeting. Normally, one of my rules is that the first time I meet someone on camera, it's the first time I've actually met them. But Max Clifford said, you know, I want to meet Louis before we start filming. So I went along And the first thing he does when you meet him, he says, he just starts saying, of course, I don't know if I can say this, is this libelous? He would sort of name a high-profile illusionist magician from America and say, oh, he's gay. He didn't go out with that person. That was all stage managed. Oh, you know that high-profile member of the royal family? He's gay. Oh, he's gay. That, she's lesbian. And he would sort of, you'd think, wow, it's really giving me the scoop. So you can't print any of this, of course. But you'd sort of, he'd fold you in, and suddenly you'd have this relationship with him where some things are on the record and some are off the record. And once that exists, you're bound into a kind of dishonesty with him, a pact in which it's sort of implicit that you're going to observe his rules about what's on the record, what's off the record. And so halfway through, I realized, hang on, this isn't working. So I said to him during filming, you know, you've got to stop doing it. You can't sort of be saying on camera, yeah, Simon's going out with this stripper called Georgina Law. And then when we put the camera down, go, of course, it's all made up. None of that's real. You know, that's soul-crushing for me as a journalist to be sort of part of your stage management of a fictional relationship.
Yeah.
And actually, it's much more interesting than for me to try and reveal the truth. So I said to him on camera, I said, like, you know, basically everything you're telling me is bollocks, because every time we stop filming, you're saying that it's rubbish. and that was the... It's actually quite a good documentary, that one. He kind of leans back in his chair and he shows his fangs and he goes, like, let me just say, I'm onto you and I'm not going to let you do that. And I was like, do what? And he goes, like, whatever it is you're trying to do. After that, he began planting negative stories. Have you seen the documentary?
Yeah.
It might be easier for you just to watch it.
It's good.
He starts planting negative stories about me in the papers. So I think the point that I was trying to make there was that, yeah, it's all fiction. It's all lies. Just so many, constantly lies. And it's just weird. If you don't lie that much, you know, I don't lie. I don't think you could ever say that. I never lie. But, you know, I don't really lie. I feel weird about lying. So when you meet someone who lies fluently and easily, it's quite a weird thing.
Yeah, well, people just, you know, it's amazing when you see people who do lie in front, like this, the lady in America who's saying she's black and she's white. That's quite a big lie, isn't it, to carry off? And then you kind of think, weren't you just scared that someone would inevitably happen?
That's slightly different. Her life was sort of founded on a kind of a lie, but it's one thing to have one lie, one very big lie, that you can't then go back on. But it's another thing to be lying sort of every day on random things, and even lying on things that don't even matter, you know? But no, I mean, I'm not pleading. I hold no brief for Rachel. What's her name? I can't pronounce her name, but I know
it might not even be a name.
I'm not trying to make that like oh, that's cool. We should all pretend to be other races. I have a degree of sort of sympathy. You know, I don't think it's like being a prolific sex offender.
Better or worse than being that. Have you met Jennifer Aniston in real life?
The thing about the Rachel, the woman we were just talking about, is her hair. It's like is it the real hair?
We'll find out, I suppose, won't we? There we go. Sometimes it's, you know.
Her hair was the blackest thing about her.
Yeah. Have you met Jennifer Aniston? Your cousin goes out with Jennifer Aniston. Have you met Jennifer?
They're engaged.
Have you met Jennifer Aniston?
Yes.
That's all I wanted to know. What was Nick Clegg like at school? You were at school with
exactly
Nick Clegg.
Like he is now.
What, a big lying idiot. He just did let everybody down and is a prick. Did you fag for Nick Clegg? Is that true?
Do people know what fagging is?
Well, I let them make their own decision based on what it sounds like.
You woke him up in the morning. All the, this is real lowest common denominator stuff, Richard. And also, like, if I'm going to give up the goods, why shouldn't I be? I should be in a higher profile forum, because this is. I feel like I'm giving you. I mean, if you appear on a chat show, they pay you like £1,000 or something, you know.
This
is like my pension.
I'm going to pay you.
This is my seed coin.
I'm going to pay you.
Get me through the long winter of my career.
I'm going to pay you depending on what you spill, what you give. You lost some marks for trying to do your Louis Theroux thing on me. That has cost you £25 right there. You woke Nick Clegg up in the morning. He was a bit older than you. You had to go and wake him up. She went to Westminster School, which, out of all the public schools, which are mainly peopled by idiots, from my recollection.
That's inverse snobbery for a start.
It is, but Westminster School seems like pretty cool. I've been there.
I didn't know you could. Okay.
And Adam and Joe were your
friends.
It's not
that cool.
Adam and Joe were there, and
they're
normal people. Nick Clegg, up until a few years ago, was a normal person.
Yeah.
I mean, they're like...
It's right in the middle of London. It's in the West End.
It's amazing.
You're exposed to normal life. You're not out in a village. You know, a lot of these public schools are out in a small village in Dorset, aren't they? So they're in this kind of weird, self-contained, slightly... Well, what's the word? It's just a insular world of where a lot of Jimmy Savilish stuff takes place, isn't it? In fact, Nick Clegg went to a school that was embroiled in one of those scandals, and I think there was a sort of paedophile ring among the teachers there.
Right.
That's not funny. Maybe that should be his... He can blame it on his upbringing.
He could do.
Any perceived fallibility in his public life, he could say, I haven't had the advantages.
Yeah.
Not funny, is it?
No.
It's very queasy, isn't it? And I think I listened to a couple of these shows, and I was like, you know, a couple of them were from before, like pre-Savile, and I was like, I don't think you could say that now. Like, it's a fine line, isn't it? Like, it's quite queasy making going between... Oh, you know, it's a joke and it's funny, and then no, it's a paedophile, and just that word's like quite a difficult thing to navigate. How do you do that?
It's difficult, but you know, there is a humorous line to tread amongst it all. But you know, because some
it's a release valve, isn't it? I mean, I'm a big believer in finding humour in macabre places.
I absolutely have to. In my current show, I do. I mean, I don't even know what I did. I haven't had any complaints, really, but one woman complained, said she didn't think child abuse was a subject for comedy. I'm trying to think what the actual stuff was about, but it's... I think it was in... I can't say, because Ben will be annoyed if I mention him again. But it was... It really is, you know, I think the reason all this stuff happened was because nobody was talking about it, right? So to start going, you mustn't... You know, I think there are jokes that you shouldn't make about it.
Yeah.
But also to not talk about it, to not see the scary, terrifying side of it. People, you know, lots of people said to me, oh, when you have a kid, you won't find those jokes funny anymore. And I still find them funny. And I make jokes. I mean, I'm terrified about my daughter dying. That's my biggest fear. But I make jokes about my daughter. And I went out the other day and my daughter wasn't feeling very well. And my wife's friend was round. And I said, oh, well, you know, take her to the doctors. But if she dies, we can just have another one. This one's quite new. And the friend went... And, you know, it's a joke because I don't want... The worst thing that could possibly happen in my life is my daughter dying. That would be absolutely the worst thing that could happen to me. And I would, you know, I don't know how anyone could cope with that or recover from that. Except that by, you know, I think by laughing at these things, and certainly before they happen, but even I think for a lot of people, you know, I think it helps people to get through that. So, you know, if you've had an awful situation, to be able to laugh in the face of it, if you, for example, were in the Holocaust or whatever... Then some people go, well, you must never joke about that. But then many Jewish comedians have made fantastic films and jokes about that. And, you know, and mocking Hitler is what people were trying to do while he was there. And he stamped out for that very reason. Because the minute you start laughing at those things, the minute
comedians and the Wehrmacht would have been completely powerless.
They were, but they
would have been quaking in their Nazi
cabaret,
boots,
isn't it?
faced with a lineup of people such as yourself.
They killed them.
You wouldn't have seen them for dust.
They killed them. That's why they stopped it all, because they knew that the minute you... I think especially with fascism, but any abuse of power, the minute you point... You know, Hitler was ridiculous. Hitler was a ridiculous figure in so many ways, and yet still managed... It's a similar thing to Savile. You know, he managed to make people believe he had this authority, or whatever, you know, and then he has that authority. If you're laughing at him, he completely deflates... Deflates it. I think, you know, they'll talk about, in Hitler Mustache, they'll talk about Charlie Chaplin, the great dictator, was actually, you know, one of the things that got America into the war was him doing this film. So it's, you know, satire has an amazing power, I think, against fascism, and I think comedy has a great power against, about laughing at, you know, I think once you can laugh at death and all of these subjects, if it's the right joke, if it's the right way of coming at it, as long as you're not coming and going, isn't it funny that people are, you know, you're not laughing at the idea of people being abused, you're laughing at the idea of anyone getting away with it, or you're finding your way through it to point out.
I think that's true up to a point, but I tend to think laughter is subversive by definition, but it can be subversive of vice, but it can also be subversive of virtue. And I think there's a lot of negative laughter.
Oh, of course, yeah. I'm not saying all jokes are fine.
And I'm not, you know, like Bernard Manning famously, you know, certainly it could be racial humour that people find funny, but it's, you know, deeply hurtful or destructive.
I think it's about.
And I think there's probably a lot of Nazi comedy that people in Germany thought was hilarious.
Of course. Well, and, you know, I can't remember which film it is, but I keep, you know, people saying you should be able to make jokes about anything and everything's funny, or if it gets a laugh, it's funny. But obviously, you know, there's a film where some Nazi guards are making Jewish people dance in the street under gunfire, and all the Nazis are laughing at the Jewish people dancing. Because they're laughing, that doesn't make that funny. That's an unacceptable thing to happen.
So, but it was like funny to them.
Exactly. But not every joke is funny. But then I think the problem is people hear you joking about something and think by joking about it, you're not taking seriously. Whereas I think that's not true. I think you can tackle a lot of serious subjects.
We should say something funny now, shouldn't we?
Yes. I tried to go into, you know, Rachel and...
Nick Clegg was a very deep sleeper.
Yeah,
that's true. So I would go around about 7:15, 7:30 in the morning, first term at Westminster, and my job was to wake everyone up and deliver their newspaper. And in all seriousness, Nick Clegg was probably the hardest person to wake up of anyone that I woke up. And
that's what the country's been feeling for the last 5 years, eh? Hey!
And there was something else I was going to say, and you kind of knocked me.
Sorry,
I
was making.
He was very. Oh yes, and so I remember saying when there was Cleggmania, the first round of Cleggmania, when they had a poll and he was more popular than Churchill. Do you remember that? It was on the cover of all the papers, and then I said, like, I used to wake him up, and then that became a big news item, and which is, it seems slightly ridiculous. And then he issued a statement saying, I have no recollection of being woken up by Louis Theroux. Which, first of all, hurts a little bit. Like, how quickly we forget. But second of all, when I thought about it, it's possibly plausible because he was in such a deep sleep and I was shaking him like that. And then maybe he was bleary for the first few minutes. So maybe he really doesn't remember.
Maybe just that he woke himself up every morning.
Maybe.
Didn't realise that was you. Banging.
Maybe he thought that's what it was, yeah. With my gentle fingers. Talk about a finger travelling through time.
We're not going to talk. I haven't asked you a single emergency question. I'm very proud of myself. Okay, it's Louis Theroux. We can't waste. There's so much stuff to talk to you about.
That'd be sad, though, if when I die, that's what I'm remembered for, is I woke up Nick Clegg.
I'm going to do my best. And
better than nothing.
A, kill you, and B, have you remembered for that. Have you ever tried to suck your own cock?
Do we have to?
No. Did you ever try to suck Nick Clegg's cock when he was asleep?
That gets applause, does it? Is that the level we're at?
I like the way I was having to go at you for being puerile and immature at the beginning of your career.
Pathetic was the word. I haven't forgotten what you said.
I am pathetic. I mean, you know, that is... you should do one of those shows about me. Oh. Um, You know, there's
no
so
is the answer.
No, it's
to okay. the Nick Clegg one.
Okay.
It's an interesting. I always respected Russell Brand. For, on his show, he gave a hand job to a tramp. Do you remember that?
I do. I talked to him about it when he came on.
I always thought that was a brave thing to do.
For the tramp or for the. It was really unpleasant. He talked about it and it was really unpleasant.
Yeah.
I mean, he was.
He told me that story.
He was very heavily on drugs and.
What did he say? He told me a thing about the tramp was having trouble. And said something like, "Can I?"
He wanted to touch
you while I'm doing it.
And then the producer
said, "Let's go on. Let's move on."
The producer said,
"It's my ambitious." Sorry, go on.
The producer said it would be funny, so he did it.
That's right.
Do you self-produce? Do you have a producer there?
Yeah,
yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
And you know, a director really is what is that I work with. Yeah. I don't do it all myself. That would be.
Well, I've got a question from the. This is Cash for Questions, Anthony Ryan. Would like to ask Louis Theroux if he ever genuinely feared for his life during an interview, because you do. I mean, I think that's it's interesting that you push it, and then I think, like, even more so in the kind of Eugene Terre Blanche kind of situation and in the prisons of San Quentin or whatever it is, that, you know, you're fronting out incredibly dangerous people with charm and asking them quite rude questions.
Well, the first thing is in prison or in jail, you're not really in that much danger as a visiting journalist. If I was spending the night there as a new inmate, different story. But it's somewhat illusory, I think, the idea that I'm going to be ushered into a cell and then just for giggles, one of the inmates is going to stab me in the neck. You know, if he's going to, because he'll pick up a new murder charge, right? And if he's going to do that, stab someone, he needs a better reason than he asked me a cheeky question. At least that's what I tell myself.
I mean, there's a lot of proper risky ones, though, surely.
I think the riskier ones, I was quite scared when I went to a neo-Nazi. It was kind of a what they call a hate core music event. So there were about 150 skinheads, and it was just weird. Just this feeling of everyone kind of hating me and hating my, you know, my crew and my director. And it's a kind of a how long have we got? It's a bit of an anecdote.
We got as long as you want.
Do a short version. We knew it was going to be dangerous, or might be. So the BBC sort of said, "Well, we think you should go in with." Protection. So they flew in two security guards who were absurd characters. Both of them looked like sort of Magnum, who, like, you know, if he'd just been eating donuts for a year.
If he'd just been eating Magnums for a year.
There you go. wearing these Hawaiian shirts that were kind of boxy, so that they, because they had these guns, and the idea was like, you know, we've made, you know, it's a skinhead event, and we've made an assessment, they'll be, Aryan Nations, Aryan Brotherhood, they're going to make a determination that you're Jewish, pointing at me. And that's not going to go well. But what we'll do close protection at all times. We'll be on either side, and we'll kind of be around. And basically, they had this scenario where they'd be around me, kind of like, so I couldn't be stabbed while I'm doing my interviews. And the whole thing was absurd, because it would have looked ridiculous, me going in a sort of, in a Magnum sandwich while doing my interviews. And then my director, Stuart, who is actually Jewish, who was getting more and more nervous, you know, as was I, in fact. And he said, by the way, you know, we can't bring any weapons in. So, you know, you can't bring your guns in. And the two bodyguards said, oh, well, we can't go in without our guns. But what we can do is we can be down the street surveilling you, and we'll be keeping a close eye on everything that happens. So completely useless. So because by the time I've been attacked and killed by one of these Aryan Brotherhood skinheads, you know, they can come and run in with their guns and sort of cradle me as I bleed to death. So they didn't come in. And then we went in and, it was sort of, it was okay. There was all this sort of like skinhead scare. Are you from the Jews media? I was like, I guess. So we call it the news media. But And we sort of, it felt kind of scary. But in fact, it went off without a hitch. And then a few weeks later, I went back and talked to two of the skinheads, and one of them got drunk. And that's actually probably the best scene in the finished doc, where he starts accusing me of being Jewish. And that felt like, because he was drunk and he was getting aggressive, like he might possibly... But, you know, I don't think that... You know, the most dangerous situations are things like riots and any time you're in a sort of turbulent environment, or chimpanzees. Because I did do a thing about... it's all about building rapport, right?
Yeah.
And even if you're with a serial killer or a deranged... you know, whoever it is, if you feel like there's eye contact, you can read the body language, the tone of voice... And you'll be fine, you know, most of the time. You know, there's a kind of, we have a language in common. With chimps, you don't have that. And also, I've been reading a lot of stuff about how they, if they go for you, they typically will rip off your genitals and also bite off your nose, which are two of my favorite features. Two of my calling cards, if you will. And... it just seems awful. And you imagine going back in the BBC saying, like, you know, we want to stand by you, and you've always got a career here. You've been wonderful, so you can still work for the BBC without a nose. Like, but they wouldn't let you present TV anymore, would they? With no nose, like that would be the end. That would be the end. It would be radio.
You could have a false.
You'd have
nose.
To get a prosthetic nose. Yeah. It'd be like Mad Max. You could have a brass nose if you see.
You could attach your nose to your glasses, though. So just
it would have to be. It would be something like that. So to me, it felt most life-threatening when I was meeting a chimpanzee. And I don't know if you saw that one.
I don't remember the chimpanzee.
Basically, I met the small chimpanzee, and then there was a bigger one who all the time I'd been interviewing his kind of parents, his human parents. So they were saying, like, well, his name's Took, and, you know, he's a lot of fun. He's very frisky. And he kept throwing things. He was in his cage, and he kept throwing things at me at the bars, right? These barrels that he had to, and I was thinking, like, he really doesn't seem to like me. They said he's pretty safe. You know, we've had him castrated, right? His penis and testicles were in a jar in the garage. So that, you know, we figure, you know, that's, you know, calmed him down a lot. And having read all these stories, and he was right on the cusp. Like, the bottom line with chimpanzees is that for the first sort of 5 or 6 years, you know, they will drink Tetley tea and have be fun and cuddle Michael Jackson, and they're all the things that you associate, like, with chimps being fun, right? Pose for birthday cards. And then when they reach sort of chimp adolescence, they become more and more feisty until they sort of go from being like cuddly bundles of fun to stone cold killers who rejoice in ripping off your testicles.
Yeah, well,
and that's the rest of the next 40 years. That's what they are. And Took was right on the turn, right? Like, could go either way. I mean, he technically was in killer country, but because his own testicles have been removed, they reckoned, like, oh no, he probably wouldn't go for you. But how do you know? Anyway, the bottom line is, I said, like, I don't even want to take the risk. Sorry, on this one, I'm not going to be the brave guy. But I'll hide in the house, and you can let him out. They really wanted him to. His claim to fame, and the reason they allowed us to film with him, was that he was the world's only swimming chimpanzee. So that was like, we really want to.
This never happened. This wasn't a Louis Farouche show.
So he comes out, swimming, and they're like, okay, we'll get him out, and you can see him swimming, and he loves it in the hot tub. So he comes out of the cage, and he kind of lopes over. This is absolutely true. He goes to the outdoor cabana where they've got a fully stocked bar. They give him a beer. He drinks, like, some of the beer. He puts it down, and then he swaggers over to the house. And we're inside the house, and it's like, oh shit, he's coming towards the house, filming through this sort of window. He comes over to the window, and he sees you, and he sees, like, a guy with a very appealing nose, tight trousers, and like my director, and also you know camera and sound, and then the next he goes over, he smashes the glass, and we're in the light like. You know, like we didn't think, like we thought we were safe in the house. We didn't think he'd come over and smash the glass and come in and rip us to pieces. They have the strength of six men. This is one of the things that's constantly being passed around. It varies, sometimes five men, sometimes 10 men, anywhere in between. But he's like, they're unbelievably strong. So he smashes the glass. And then thankfully, like, it was always like, oh, I wasn't, but I think he just wanted to beat on the glass, you know, and like, he thought it was going to make a cool noise, but it broke. And I think that shocked him. And then he kind of loped away. But that felt to me like the closest, if you could call that an interview, that felt to me like the closest I got to being beaten up.
I don't think that happened.
It's in there.
Did that happen the same week you were interviewing people about crystal meth addiction? And this. Yeah, and then there was this monkey. He came swimming, monkey. Came trying to rip off my genitals to replace his own genitals. We don't have. We pretty much. I mean, we could talk to you. There's so much to talk to you about.
I'd love to.
I was interested if you'd. I loved the one where you went to the Westboro Baptist
Church, yeah.
And there was the girl that you kind of seemed to get quite close to, and did you convince her to leave in the end, or
well,
she left?
There's a sort of two things. There were several young women there at that time, and basically the one that I sort of found the most interesting, you know, based on my sense that she was sort of in turmoil about what she was doing. I did a follow-up. When I went back for the follow-up, she'd not only become more embedded, more indoctrinated, she had married a British man who'd gone over there having seen my first documentary. So I kind of unwittingly match-made, which is a little disappointing.
It's pretty bad if someone's watched that documentary and gone, you know where I want to go. Yeah. Although they were very, they were appealing because they were so, you know, it was so, what's happened to them was so horrible that I can see you kind of beginning, I'd like to go and save those poor women from this awful.
Right, but he didn't think that. He thought I want to go over there and continue doing that crazy stuff. But there were two other girls who I got to know, who I thought were more solid, like the sort of true believers, and they left. In fact, there were three that left.
Right.
And so when I did the follow up, I met them and found out why they'd left.
And were you happy when was it Fred?
Fred died.
Fred died.
You know, I don't. You know, I didn't feel. I don't think. I wasn't happy. You know, I didn't feel, I wasn't sad, you know. I don't rejoice, I don't think I do, like in people dying. But I suppose I didn't really have any feelings about it.
Well, do you think they'll carry on without him?
Wasn't really, he'd become a passenger, kind of. Having invented their doctrine and dictated, you know, their pickets, and the fact that they would go and picket at the funerals of soldiers and other high-profile people waving offensive placards. Do I need to tee up what they do? Some people may not have seen the program.
Yeah.
And placards that would say, God hates fags, fags eat poop, and so on and so on. That was his kind of, that was his revelation that's what we should all be doing. But up towards the end, he'd become slightly irrelevant. He'd become a sort of embarrassing granddad. And he'd even been excommunicated from the church, which I think doesn't mean that much, except he wasn't allowed to preach. And, you know, he had to stay in his granny annex. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I don't think... So towards the end, it had taken on a life of its own. It was very much being driven by his children.
Yeah. She's pretty...
Shirley.
Yeah, she's pretty phenomenal.
She was driving it. But now I think, I mean, I don't know how interested in the kind of internal politics of the Westboro Baptist Church people are, but I think she's been sidelined now.
Right.
And the guy called Steve Drain, who was the documentary maker who went there before I did to make a film about them and then ended up kind of being converted.
Yeah.
And had become sort of the most fire breathing and extreme of all of them. He I think is kind of, I don't know about running the show, but he's calling the shots. Yeah. Now, I think, to an extent.
Do you think any of them will ever, any of these people will ever convert you to their, you'll go along and become part
of any of the stories that I do?
Yeah.
You know, but I've got to the point now where, you know, I do shows about people that, you know, actually, you know, I've done stories about people who through no fault of their own either have had life-threatening illnesses or mental illness or Alzheimer's and so on. You know, I think... And clearly that's something that anyone could be affected by. You know, I think my sort of pathetic, your word, fantasy is probably that I'll be maybe like I could become a full-time psychiatrist at a forensic hospital or something. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you know, I feel like I've learned enough about psychiatry that I could fake it pretty well.
I guess when you did Paul Daniels, you sort of became friends in the end of that one, didn't you? After
I didn't see him. We didn't mix socially. The sad thing is, like, of all the people that I've met, you know, in terms of the celebrity ones over the years, I kept in touch with Jimmy Savile. Like, I used to see him a fair bit after the shows, after the show was finished, which makes it even weirder, right?
Yeah, you haven't chosen well with the people.
I never thought, but you know what it was? It wasn't like, oh, me and Jimmy are mates now. It was what it was this feeling that I hadn't kind of got to the end. That I hadn't quite figured out. I can't believe it's me that's coming back to Jimmy Savile, because I always feel like I should probably stay away from the subject. It's just still too raw. But you know, I always felt, you know. He used to do a lot of work at Broadmoor, and he was on the board of governors. And I'd known that he had some sort of a relationship with Peter Sutcliffe, right? And in fact, one of the things he said to me in one of his sort of mysterious, tantalizing moments, but this is a typical sort of thing that Jimmy Savile would say in his kind of macabre moods, was I said to him, "Have you been following this whole thing with Myra Hindley, the Myra Hindley story?" Because at that time, I think I can't remember what it was. I think she was trying to get out. Mm-hmm. And he said, "I am the Myra Hindley story." I was like, "Well, what does that mean?" But I didn't follow up and say, like, what does that mean? Yeah. Because I knew that he'd then retreat. He just wanted to tantalize and sort of suggest, like, well, either he's saying he is a prolific criminal and psychopath, or he's saying, "I know everything about everything that happens at every forensic hospital in the country." Anyway, though, so I always felt like there was this sort of, this side of Jimmy Savile that was fascinated by psychopaths, Peter Sutcliffe, serial killers that would joke about and that would sort of that would enjoy spending time with these guys. And whenever I went back with him, I would always be like, "Hey, when are we going to go down to Broadmoor, you know, and we can sort of hang out down there?" And I thought maybe that would be my entree into understanding that side of his personality. Like, that I just, at some point, he'd sort of give up the goods. But he never really did.
There's a good thing when you and Adam and Joe sing in Grooves in Dancer to Grooves in the Heart.
That is a good clip.
I wanted to watch that on YouTube. It's good fun.
That is a fun.
How old are you in that clip?
20?
Oh, you look about 15. Very sweet. It's been really... We're going to have to stop. There's so much more I would love to talk to you about. It's been absolutely fascinating to talk to you. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Louis Theroux! Richard Herring's That's the Square Theatre podcast with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Louis Theroux. Hear the music. Yeah, I always forget who it's by. It's by Pest, and they're really good. Listen to them playing their instruments now. Thank you to everyone at the Leicester Square Theatre. Thank you to everyone who contributed to the Kickstarter that made this go on video. It would have been on audio anyway, so, you know, fuck you. And thank you also to the people from Go Faster Strike. Chris Evans, not that one, or that one, or that one. It's the other one. He eats seaweed, that one. The one with seaweed all over his face. And to all of his crazy gang of people who do the recordings. I would also very much like to thank Ben Walker, my producer, who produced this. Thank you, Ben. I would just like to thank you personally for that. This is a Fuzz, Sky Potato, and GoFasterStrike.com production.
Thank you very much for listening to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. You can help support us by going to gofasterstripe.com/badges and buying a badge. Or I'm sure there'll be another Kickstarter campaign for the next series, so maybe hold up your money for that if you love Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. I just want to give a shout out to Chris Hopkins, who paid some money for us to do that and then didn't even leave anything to say. He just wants his name. It's now gone down in record, Chris. You'll never be forgotten. In centuries, people will be watching this. And they'll go, I wonder who the mysterious Chris Hopkins was. So thanks for watching. Go to leicestersquaretheatre.com to buy tickets to see the shows or to see any of my 12 one-man shows that I'm doing in August and September if you are in London or can get here easily. Here are some of the names of some of the other people who have helped us make this series of Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. I feel a bit like this is the Oscars and these are the people who've died this year. Let's make out ears. If they all do die this year, this will be chillingly worrying. They are Matthew Smith, Ewan Duncan, Rob Applin, Darren Foote, Colin Anderson, Raymond Harpany, Kevin Tipcorn, Steve Mash, Dean Ratland, Gaynor Wilson, Adam Queck, Stuart Fawcett, Tim Turner, Julian Benton, Thomas Baldwin, Lauren Pilkington, Matthew Blackburn, Neil Martin, Jack Burton, Fraser Levy, Gina Lynn, Paul Jeffrey, Rob Ward, Robert Tang Richardson, Leo Vigoda, Carol Forster, Icky Kawa, Colm McGonagall, Aurora Watters, Jake, Heather Henderson, Simon Carl, Christine Sato, David Collier, Jijin John, Roy Owens, Matthew Poynton, and Nick Hayward. What, from Haircut 100? Well, it might be. Graham Norgate, he's got lots of money, I expect. Fantastic day. Asif Khan, Beck Evans, Jack Brooks, Steve O'Connor, Steve Pagioli, Ben Hayward, John, and Adrian Ryder. Thanks to all of you guys for helping us out. Now go away and come back next week when there'll be some more.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Thanks for listening. Go to gofasterstripe.com for all your Richard Herring download and book needs. Go to richherring.com/gigs to find out if Can I Have My Ball Back is coming near to you. And please listen to as many podcasts on this feed as you possibly can and make your family and friends and children and strangers, make them listen too. Do get consent from everyone before you make them listen, though. All right, thanks for listening. Go and listen to another one. Bye-bye.